Hello, welcome to the second installment of Poster, the audio newsletter of Poster House, the first and only poster museum in the United States. I'm your host, Stephen Heller. This second season includes two new shows that will be very surprising. Both shows are filled with handmade work.
There's a lot to learn about the blending and mixing of colors.
We're going to hear about the painted, one-of-a-kind posters from the makeshift movie theaters of Ghana.
Every day is full of interesting activity.
To the brightly scrawled and collaged placards from the Women's March on the streets of Boston.
New ideas to explore, old skills to enjoy.
We'll see a range of skilled artists and total amateurs with a burning passion for either movies or politics.
And the fun of doing worthwhile things together.
Let's talk first with Chief Curator of Poster House, Angelina Lippert, about Baptized by Beefcake, the golden age of hand-painted movie posters from Ghana. Hi, Angelina.
Hi, Steve.
The title alone, Baptized by Beefcake, is provocative. I don't think I've ever heard these two words together in one sentence. So in a few words, what does Baptized by Beefcake represent?
Well, first, I have to give a shout out to our PR guy, Ed Winstead, for coming up with Baptized by Beefcake. It's bonkers and fabulous and really sums up the show perfectly. Baptized is obviously a religious word, specifically relating to how a person becomes part of a religious community or enters into a relationship with God. Meanwhile, beefcake is a word that I believe entered common parlance in the 1970s as it referred to a hyper-muscular, sexy dude. Think Fabio on the cover of any romance novel, or probably more relevant to this show, Arnold Schwarzenegger when he was competing for the title of Mr. Universe. These posters bring these concepts together in a really unexpected and fascinating way.
And what makes this the golden age of hand-painted Ghanaian movie posters?
Well, prior to the year 2000, these posters were made as functional objects for a Ghanaian audience, which means they are keying into specific imagery and messaging that means something to locals, which may not have any great meaning to someone outside of that culture. For example, we have one poster in the show for the film Splash.
Splash. A fantastic tale about a fantastic tale.
The face of Daryl Hannah has been almost completely worn away because people passing the poster touched her reverentially. In West Africa, there is a belief in a deity called Mamiwata or Mammy Water, who looks an awful lot like a mermaid. So touching her is comparable to how Catholics touch holy water when leaving or entering a church. It's like a blessing.
Just touching her is a lifelong fantasy come true. Just being in love with her plunges him into a wondrous world of rapture and enchantment.
After the year 2000, these posters stopped being used in Ghana to advertise movies because people had wider access to TVs and DVDs of their own. So we call the period before 2000 the Golden Age because it was a time period within this artistic style for Ghanaians by Ghanaians.
Would you say that these posters, which are painted on burlap flour sacks rather than on wood or poster board, were the work of naïfs, or have the 22 artists in the show had some formal training?
Now, that's a really loaded question. So many scholars who talk about these artists refer to them as self-taught. In all but one instance, every artist in the show studied with a master for around 4 years before going off on their own. Ghana has a long history of a master-apprentice structure for sign painters, and even had established courses in sign painting at Western-style universities within the country. So these aren't guys who woke up one morning and decided to play around with a brush and some paint. They learned from someone who had learned from someone else, creating this lineage of styles which are obvious in this show.
These posters are variations of Hollywood blockbusters like Rambo and Terminator. So why couldn't the film purveyors simply get existing printed movie posters?
Well, first and foremost, none of these films were imported legally. They were either recorded off of satellite TV, brought in by European sailors, or most commonly sent over from abroad by friends and family who had moved there. So how would they have access to the official poster? They're also getting films that are, in many cases, a decade old and more in line with B-movies than blockbusters. So Toxic Avenger is a movie in which a skinny wimp from New Jersey falls into a vat of toxic waste and acquires superpowers.
Meet little Melvin. He's a 90-pound weakling. Everyone hated Melvin.
Yeah, I'm gonna take this mop and shove it down your throat.
All of these posters traveled with the videotape of the film and were typically nailed to a board outside an ad hoc open-air theater, which was typically a town square or someone's living room. They were rained on, they were splattered with dirt and mud, and then they were rolled up to go on to the next town.
They tormented him until he had a horrifying accident and fell into a vat of nuclear waste.
These posters traveled this way for years. We have some that were so damaged over time that you can see places where ripped up jeans and rags were sewn onto the flour sacks in order to reinforce them. A paper poster just wouldn't cut it.
Melvin became the Toxic Avenger.
So how do these posters fit into or are influenced by Ghanaian culture? And how did they get muddled with Western culture?
In the late 1980s, the government loosened its hold on what types of media could be brought into Ghana, which means you had a sudden influx of VHS tapes from Europe and the United States. And these movies are way more entertaining and with more fabulous special effects than anything most people in Ghana had access to before. But instead of being seen solely as an action film or a horror movie, they're read as extensions of Ghanaian stories, myths, and religious beliefs. So Terminator becomes a parable about Jesus saving the world from certain doom. One of my absolute favorite pieces in the show is a poster for a ghost. Now, the poster does not depict a single scene from the actual movie. Instead, you see Patrick Swayze standing under a quote about revenge and Whoopi Goldberg's head bursting through Demi Moore's stomach like a scene from Alien. In West Africa, there is this long-standing concept of the revenge ghost, a spirit who can haunt those of the living world in order to seek revenge for wrongs committed during their lifetime. In fact, if you Google Ghana revenge ghost movie, you'll see that there are literally dozens of locally made contemporary films with titles like I Married a Revenge Ghost or My Baby is a Revenge Ghost Part 4. And what is Ghost with Patrick Swayze but a film about a spirit who seeks revenge for his own murder?
Sam?
Molly?
I can hear you.
I can see there's a lot going on here. Did each distributor hire artists to copy the Western posters, or was there license to play with image and lettering?
Well, the distributors hired the artists to create the posters. But for the most part, the artists were not copying movie posters, but rather the art on the VHS or PAL tape boxes. In the early years, you see a fairly literal copying occurring with maybe a few flourishes here and there for added effect. For example, the Aliens poster in the show is an exact copy of the box cover, with the addition of an actual alien's body hovering above Sigourney Weaver. Then toward the latter half of the 90s, artists are taking way more leeway with how they interpret the films. Some just pick and choose the most action-packed bits of each movie and create a visual montage, while others will make up what they feel will bring in the biggest audience.
These posters have an iconic component that comes from charismatic religion. Where does the Pentecostalism and Predator or Toxic Avenger component meet?
Pentecostalism is the largest denomination of Christianity in Ghana, to the point where it enters every part of daily life. It's not unusual to find shops or restaurants with religious names, like Almighty God Artworks, which is a sign painting workshop in Accra, or to have people take on religious names as part of their public identities. For example, J.J. Rawlings, who ruled Ghana through the 80s and 90s, told people that JJ stood for Junior Jesus. When religion, especially a charismatic sect like Pentecostalism, is so ingrained into the social fabric, everything takes on a religious overtone.
You actually have lived with these images for quite a while now. How did you respond when you first saw them?
Oh, I've been aware of these posters for a long time. In fact, when I was interviewing for the job at Poster House, I brought up wanting to do a show based around them. I was simply attracted to these larger-than-life, over-the-top images that made movie posters bigger and badder than I'd ever seen them. Everyone visiting the show will be captivated by the graphics, but I think the story that we've uncovered is far more compelling and brings the posters to a whole new level of amazing.
Thank you, Angelina.
Thanks, Steve.
The second exhibition is titled 2020 Insight, Posters from the 2017 Women's March. It's a collection of handmade placards protesting against the election of Donald J. Trump. This exhibition is designed as a timeline that addresses the genesis of these demonstrations and the signs and symbols that express them. With us is curator Melissa Walker. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Stephen.
Melissa, how many posters and signs did you acquire, and how did this material come together as a collection?
This collection of posters came from the Boston Women's March. That march was held around the Boston Common and ended near the Central Burying Ground. People left their signs all along the iron fence there, and three professors asked the city park workers for permission to collect them. It was my understanding all these posters were headed for the trash. So they were gathered, photographed, and boxed up. And we received about 4,000 posters, which honestly is just an estimate, as I haven't finished cataloging them yet. Every time I open a box, it feels like a tiny protest has broken out.
We're in an election cycle right now, hard to believe. What do you want people to take away from this show?
I really want to encourage participation. As a person who works for a poster museum, I'm invested in poster history. And I loved going through this archive and discovering that people love poster history too. They have a relationship to it, whether they know it or not. And these indelible images from the past, these slogans from the Second World War, they still resonate with folks. And a fist inside of a female glyph still means something. In some ways, it's bittersweet because it means maybe there hasn't been as much progress as there needs to be. But going forward, I really do believe in the inspiration of these images, that protesting is part of the American culture, our landscape. I mean, our country started with a protest. We dumped tea into the bay. And, you know, we've been protesting ever since.
And Benjamin Franklin did the first political cartoon by cutting up a snake.
There you go. Join or die.
Join or die. You know, it's interesting for me as I looked at the images that you have, I was thinking back to the Vietnam War protests. And, of course, there are similarities. But there's also something that I didn't catch in the 2017 marches. In the peace marches of the Vietnam era, there were one or two very common posters, ubiquitous posters, like war is unhealthy for children and other living things. And I remember seeing them en masse being marched down Fifth Avenue. There didn't seem to be any unified poster for this march. Did you find that?
There were a lot of takes on posters. So unfortunately, we lost Carrie Fisher right before this protest happened. And of course, she played Princess Leia. And her image appeared on many posters with the slogan, "A woman's place is in the resistance." And her picture was used again and again, and it was reformatted over and over in different ways. So you would see people would just sort of print it off the internet and write it in Sharpie. And then other people who had access to Photoshop or other design tools would make these elaborate, you know, beautiful, beautifully executed things. And to me, I value both expressions equally. Like, we even have posters that are scrawled on a pizza box. And I think that those deserve study and a place on the wall. So those are some of the posters I saw that were kind of ubiquitous, but it was very much in the moment. You know, she had just passed away, and that was something that grew out of that.
This march was promoted on the internet, and you have a section on internet influence. Can you explain this concept?
Sure. Many posters have hashtags on them, which in real life don't work. I found that fascinating, as hashtags use language in an unnatural way, but are related to political slogans you often find on posters. So hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag Me Too, hashtag Say Her Name. There are many that appear on the signs. And also there are posters that use memes, you know, cropped images from popular culture with words on top of them. There are also posters that use emojis. It's like protesters were trying to communicate with the government using their phones, but in paper form.
Right. It has been said that those who own a printing press own power. Now everybody owns a printing press. And so those printouts that were available from different sites online must have been manifold.
Yes, that happened a lot. And some of the designers took into account that while they might be designing for their particular concern, they might have overlooked something else. So they almost had a fill-in-the-blank kind of aesthetic. So it would say, I'm marching for blank. And then you could write it in with your Sharpie marker and put it on your pizza box.
And now the Sharpie is a bad tool, thanks to Donald J.
How dare he?
How dare he? First the tiki lamps and now the Sharpies.
Ugh.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa, for this. I think it's great that we have these posters in the exhibit that were saved. So many of them were headed for the trash barrel that I saw in New York, and this is a real piece of history.
Exactly.
So there you have it. Two very unique exhibitions, each with a specific purpose, but with something in common. Both are handmade. These shows will be on view until January 5th, 2020, with a number of special events open to the public. Check the Poster House website for dates and times. Our executive producer is Julia Knight. Our producer and editor is Pike Malinowski. Original music by Bob Pounding. Our curators are Angelina Lippert and Melissa Walker. For insights into forthcoming exhibitions, stay posted. I'm Stephen Heller. Thanks for listening.